Good evening. This is the KRFP Evening Report for Monday, March 10th, 2014. I'm Lee Robartis in the news tonight. Burlington Northern Santa Fe spokesperson says oil trains from North Dakota likely to increase in number in northern Idaho in the next year. Kootenai County Sheriff's Department ends charter contract with Boy Scouts of America Troop 911 because of the Boy Scouts' new policy allowing gays. House passes changes in homeowners' income tax exemption cap, and city committee hears about accessory buildings and whether they can be zoned for habitation in Moscow. We'll have details on those stories and more coming up on the KRFP Evening Report. And live in the KRFP studios in Moscow, Idaho, I'm Lee Robartis, and this is the KRFP Evening Report. The Idaho House voted 54-16 today to remove an indexing plan for the setting of homeowners' exemptions to property taxes, replacing it with a $90,000 cap or 50% of the home's value, whichever is less. The legislature tied the maximum level to the Idaho Housing Index in 2006. Bill sponsor, Republican Representative Janet Trujillo of Idaho Falls, said during the recent housing collapse, the index did create some very negative consequences for taxpayers. As home values were dropping, the taxes were actually increasing. I believe that removing the index makes good sense for the state of Idaho. House Bill 594 now heads to the Senate. A bill modifying payday loan rules in Idaho passed the Senate 21-13 today. Senate Bill 1314, sponsored by Republican Senator Lee Hyder of Twin Falls, would allow people in debt to have a once-per-year option to get an extended payment plan without new fees or interest. The bill also bans payday loans that are larger than 25% of the monthly income of the borrower. The bill now heads to the House. A bill that would allow Idaho judges to require those on probation to take sobriety tests twice per day has passed a Senate panel and is on its way to the full Senate. The law would apply to those convicted of alcohol or drug-related crimes. The bill is sponsored by Republican Representative Luke Malik of Coeur d'Alene. Burlington Northern Santa Fe Railroad spokesperson Gus Milonis has told the Coeur d'Alene Press the number of oil trains passing through the Idaho Panhandle is likely to increase during the next year. Milonis said it's all demand-driven, but we certainly know it's a growing trend. He said currently an average of 1.5 Burlington Northern Santa Fe trains per day carrying North Dakota Bakken crude oil through Northern Idaho on their way to terminals and refineries on the coast. The trains travel through Sandpoint, Athol, Rathdrum, and Hauser. Milonis said the trains usually have about 100 cars. Each car holds 29,000 gallons of crude. Federal transportation officials are investigating whether Bakken crude oil is more flammable than other types of crude after three fiery oil train derailments involving the North Dakota oil during the last year, including a runaway train in Quebec that exploded in downtown La Mégantique, killing 47. The other railroad running trains through the panhandle, Union Pacific, also carries some Bakken crude. Union Pacific spokesperson Aaron Hunt said it carries oil in cars interspersed with other commodities. Railroads across the U.S. carried 400,000 carloads of crude oil last year, up from 9,500 carloads in 2008. The Kootenai County Sheriff's Office has let its contract with Boy Scouts Troop 911 in Coeur d'Alene expire because of the Boy Scouts' new policy announced last year, lifting a ban on gay scouts. Kootenai County Sheriff Ben Wolfinger said last year he would drop the charter of the Boy Scouts Troop because it promotes a lifestyle that's against Idaho law. A seldom enforced Idaho law bans sodomy. Boy Scouts of America Inland Northwest Council CEO Tim McCandless told the Coeur d'Alene Press Northwest Backcountry Rescue is chartering Troop 911 now. Referring to Troop 911, McCandless told the paper, it has great adult leadership, a strong charter, and it has been very active. McCandless said the sheriff's office only chartered the troop for 1 year after inheriting it from the Kootenai County Search and Rescue Council in December 2012. He said it was a fluke that the sheriff's department got the charter because Inland Northwest Council does not usually issue charters to government agencies. Moscow Community Development Director Bill Belknap gave the City Council's Administrative Committee an overview this afternoon on proposals being considered by the Planning and Zoning Commission to allow accessory dwelling units in some parts of the city. Here's part of Belknap's presentation in which he discusses a public open house in which the issue was talked about and a survey conducted.
An accessory dwelling unit is a separate additional living unit that is incidental and accessory to a principal dwelling unit on a lot, and that principal dwelling unit that it's accessory to is a single family dwelling. It is something that is oftentimes referred to as a mother-in-law apartment, but that does not mean, and I want to make it clear, that it's not restricted to that as being the occupant of these types of dwellings. There may be situations where there are elderly or disabled family members that might reside in these, but just as well in a college town like Moscow, it would be a couple of college students, or it could be a young, couple that may be residing in a unit. So there's no limitation or proposed limitation of having to be a family member or related or being of a certain age to reside in the unit. So I do want to, it's an accessory apartment. It's a small scale accessory apartment that is accessory to a single family dwelling. They're generally small scale in size, so they're typically studio or one bedroom units. The intent is not to change the character of the surrounding property or the neighborhood. They often can be within the principal structure itself, for example, in a basement apartment, or they may be in a detached structure, or maybe above a detached garage, or just in a detached structure on the property. Very commonly, there's a requirement that the owner of the property reside either within the principal dwelling or the accessory unit itself. That is oftentimes to ensure that it's a compatible use with the neighborhood, that it's well supervised, that the occupants of the ADU are good neighbors in the neighborhood. And because of the small-scale nature of the units, oftentimes they provide affordable housing options or housing options for smaller households. And they also provide a means of income for the residents, owners of the property, as they look to their retirement and potentially increasing income or providing some additional supplemental income in retirement. And then they also may help family members care for a elderly or disabled family member while still providing them a certain level of independence in that living arrangement. The Planning and Zoning Commission really has been having the conversation over the last year. Actually began in the fall of 2012 when they submitted the questions for the citizen survey, received the responses to those questions in the spring of 2013, and we solicited some code input and some input from the participants. We had a survey instrument that we had out, physical hard copies at the open house meeting. We also posted online on the project's website on the planning department's page to solicit input about the participants' opinions, and so we just had a few responses here. This is only 28 respondents, so we had probably 30 or 40 people during the course of the open house meeting. Not everybody filled out a survey instrument, so we had a certain number that we received that evening. Then we had a certain number of folks that filled out and completed the survey on SurveyMonkey on the web version of it. So it's important to make a distinction between these responses that come from a very small self-selected sample as compared to the citizen survey as a whole random statistical survey and random sample that is anticipated to reflect more closely the broader community opinion. We then did ask questions about whether they should be permitted in the R3 and the R4 districts or in the R1 and R2 districts. So now this is going beyond just their neighborhood, but should they be maybe just in this district? The R2 and R3 are already more intense residential districts, two-family and multifamily dwellings. And so to that question, we had 43% that strongly agreed or agree that they should be allowed within the R3 and the R4 district, and only had 18% that either disagreed or strongly disagreed with that statement. So, and 29% that were neutral. Again, we had a large number of the individuals coming to the meeting that were in the R1 and the R2 districts, so that's not surprising. that they may not have a strong opinion about allowing them in a different zoning district. But that was the response there. And then would they permit support them being allowed accessory use in the R1 and the R2 district? Again, we had, oh, I went the wrong way. We have, 46% that strongly agreed or agreed with that statement, and 36% that disagreed or strongly disagreed. So starting to get to a little, obviously, still somewhat strong, you know, obviously much more, still fairly strong support, but, again, becoming more polarized as we move into the R1 and the R2 district in the responses. We also asked about their relative importance of elements that could be regulating standards for ADUs, the first of which is hard to read as design, location of entrances, owner occupancy, off-street parking, maximum occupancy, and maximum size limits. And the blue bars are extremely important, and the purple is very important. When you go into the yellow, it's not important, and the red is somewhat important. So you can see, obviously, the two that were very important to the respondents was owner occupancy and maximum occupancy, so the maximum number of individuals that could reside in the ADU and the fact that the owner resided on the property. Second were parking and size limits. Location of entrance and design were of less importance to the participants in the process, so that was the response to that question. Now, if we were to look at just the R1 and R2 respondents and segregate out those individuals and look at the responses to the question about whether they support them in their neighborhood, you can see we have a 50-50, 56% that agreed, strongly agreed, and 44% that strongly disagreed. So certainly you can see that there's less unanimous support for them for the respondents that resided within our predominantly single-family residential zoning districts in the community.
That was Moscow Community Development Director Bill Belknap speaking to the City Council's Administrative Committee this afternoon. Belknap says the plan is to have a second open house once more specific changes to the city zoning code are proposed regarding accessory dwelling units. The Idaho House Revenue and Taxation Committee voted today along party lines to increase the exemption of the personal property tax on business equipment from $100,000 per property owner per county to $250,000 per property owner per county. The bill also codifies that pipelines, underground storage tanks, cell phone towers, and railroad tracks are included under the exemption after the State Tax Commission decided last year those forms of property did not qualify as real property under the tax law. House Majority Leader Mike Moyle of Star said the goal is to ultimately end the tax for everybody. Two of the businesses that have applied for a Washington license in Pullman to produce recreational cannabis say they plan to use their grow operations for research as well as growing marijuana to sell to retailers. Trent Mayer told the Daily News he and business partners Carl Schmokel and Brian Ogdahl plan to test inventions that would benefit the legal cannabis industries. He said all three partners have backgrounds in electrical engineering. Mayer said the only way to justify working on this is to be able to have the license so we can grow and test these products. There's certainly an opportunity here, not just for growing and selling that product, but also in developing systems that do that. If Mayer and his partners get a cannabis license, they plan on using a building Mayer currently uses for producing hard cider on the airport road to grow on some of the 7,000 square feet of grow space authorized. William R. Buckley of Sunshine Ranch and Stables told the paper he would use his recreational cannabis producer license to fund genetic research into the plant, which can be applied to machines. Buckley said marijuana, like every other multicellular creature, follows a developmental program. Once we understand that genetic network, it will be easier to apply to non-biological machines. Buckley said his company plans on growing cannabis on the old Moscow Highway east of Pullman. A 6.9 magnitude earthquake struck off the coast of Humboldt County, California last night at 9:18 p.m. The National Tsunami Warning Center said there was no danger of a tsunami from the quake 50 miles west of Eureka and 4 miles beneath the ocean floor. There were no reports of injuries or structural damage as of last night. You're listening to the KRFP Evening Report. This is KRFP Moscow. The Idaho Legislature's Joint Finance Appropriations Committee has allocated $492 million in state general fund money for the Department of Health and Welfare's Division of Medicare and Medicaid. The Lewiston Tribune reports the rest of the division's $2.03 billion budget will come from federal and dedicated funds. The committee set the welfare division's budget of the Health and Welfare Department at $151 million, including $39 million from the state general fund. The rest of the budget will consist of $112 million in federal and dedicated spending. The window for candidates to file to be on the ballot in Idaho this year closes this Friday. So far, only one candidate has filed for each of the three District 5 legislative seats representing Latah and Benoit counties. Democratic Senator Dan Schmidt and Republican Representative Cindy Agidias, both of Moscow, are running for re-election. The only candidate filing so far for Democratic Representative Shirley Ringo's seat is Republican Carol Nilsen Troy of Genesee. Ringo is running for the 1st District Congressional seat, now held by Republican Raul Labrador. Labrador is facing a primary challenge from Michael Greenway of Eagle and Reed McCandless of Moscow. After 4 years of work, the Umatilla, Wallawa, Whitman, and Malheur National Forests are expected to release their draft forest plan Friday this week, which covers much of the Blue Mountains in Oregon and Washington and much of eastern Oregon's national forest areas. The plan will include recommendations on wilderness designation and outline where recommended areas for logging, grazing, and motorized recreation should be. The closest public meeting on the forest's plan will be held Thursday, April 3rd at 5:30 p.m. in Dayton, Washington. Republican Representative Jason Monks of Meridian introduced a bill last week that would keep all of Idaho on daylight savings time all year long. Monks told the Lewiston Tribune there's actually a rationale behind this bill. It's not just that we're tired of changing clocks. Monks says research has shown heart attacks, workplace injuries, traffic accidents, and headaches increase in the few days after time changes. Lawmakers have yet to schedule a hearing on the bill. House Majority Mike Moyle of Star said the delay is because half the people want the state to stick with Mountain Time and half want Idaho on Pacific Time. The Spokesman Review has noted six fires have destroyed mostly rural bars in the Idaho Panhandle and far western Montana in the last year, and five of the fires are unsolved. The paper reports fire and law enforcement officials they spoke to feel the fires are likely unrelated, but the respective state fire marshals of Idaho and Montana said they will take a look now that they are aware of the cluster of bar fires. Bar fires in the remote towns of Avery, Idaho, Osborne, Idaho, Mullen, Idaho, Paradise, Montana, and on a rural area south of Yak, Montana, burned long before fire crews arrived, making it difficult to determine the causes of the fires. The fire that destroyed the Golden Nugget Bar and Grill near Yak, Montana, is especially suspicious because the owner was a repentant former Grand Dragon of the Ku Klux Klan who was sentenced to 12 years in prison for burning down a Kentucky church that had a pastor who criticized the KKK. Owner Robbie Tackett wrote in the introduction to his 2009 book, Inside the Ku Klux Klan, that he had wasted 15 years of his life by his activities with the Klan, and said, "I have taken a great risk in writing this book, as you can imagine. It is worth my life to tell you the truth, however. I have been able to live a quiet life since being released, a life without fear of attack from unknown enemies. This book will end that instantly." Tackett's Golden Nugget Bar was fully engulfed when firefighters arrived after driving nearly an hour on icy roads February 12th. The Spokesman Review could not contact Tackett for comment. The other bar fires noted in the region in the last year destroyed the Silver Dollar Bar in Mullen May 13th of last year, the St. Joe Pub and Grill in Avery July 16th, The Longhorn Sports Bar in Osborne, also on July 16th. The American Legion Bar in Paradise, Montana, July 31st. And the A&P Bar and Grill in downtown Sandpoint, February 6th. Fire officials have only ruled on the cause of the Sandpoint Bar fire, which was deemed accidentally caused by a misplaced burning cigarette while the bar was being remodeled. The Paradise, Montana Bar burned 4 years after another bar in Paradise, the Paradise Bar, spelled PAIR-A-DICE, was destroyed by a fire of undetermined origin. Well, that's it for the KRFP Evening Report for tonight. Taking a look at the weather from the National Weather Service. 70% chance of rain showers before midnight tonight, then a slight chance of snow showers, some thunder also possible. Patchy fog after midnight, otherwise mostly cloudy, low 32, wind gusts up to 25 from the west, little or no snow accumulation expected. Tomorrow mostly sunny, high 47, patchy fog before noon, partly cloudy. Tomorrow night, low 29, and sunny Wednesday and Thursday, highs 54. Currently a few clouds, 48 degrees. Thanks for tuning in to the KRFP Evening Report. Coming up next is news and opinions from the west side to Eat the Airwaves, followed by Flashpoints, the daily investigative news magazine from Pacifica Radio, and that'll be followed live in the studio by Climate Justice Forum. I'm Lee Robartis. Have a good night. Be sure to donate to Radio Free Moscow to help us keep these newscasts on the air. This is KRFP Moscow Pullman, 90.3.